The first half of chapter 3, which includes the story of Nicodemus' nighttime visit to Jesus, is a justly famous summary of the Christian gospel. John 3:16 has been described as the gospel in a nutshell.
Sorry, Beulah, I'm interrupting you. Read more, Beulah.
For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life.
Okay, Jane, read the next three lines for us.
We've noticed the range and depth of meaning in believe, pistiano.
Oh, I misspelled it actually. It shouldn't be two U's. Pistuo. Yes?
Pistuo. In every session so far. Here is the strongest form of the verb, pistuo, ice, to trust into, i.e. commit ourselves to. And it's interesting to modern sensibilities that the word here is cosmos, the cosmos, or whole created order.
Okay, it's nothing very significant there. We've done pistuo before, and do you remember I said to you that it means a whole range of stuff, from sort of having opinions right through to committing yourself to, and there's various clues as to which is being meant, and the clue here is the into. It's the strongest version of it. And again, nothing very surprising, but world. The cosmos is the whole created order. And I think there's great depth in that, you know, that the world is God's world, was not to be abused or neglected. Aliens turn out to be God's aliens when we meet them, you know, that God would want to redeem them as well. So it's not just human beings. Mm. Just a little thing, the cosmos. It just feels bigger than world to me, the cosmos.
Mm. Well, and I think historically some branches of the church have pulled in the redeeming work of Christ too much, in that it's all about me and God, whereas what this is saying is much, much bigger than that.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The whole thing becomes partistic. Yeah, it's just little me and my friend God. Yes. We really get going in the next bit, though, if we may. So, Mike, could you read the next little bit?
Yes. Something new to notice in this chapter is the ambiguity of the word you in English, so that sometimes important things are lost in translation. An example is verse 11.
Keep going.
Very truly, I tell you, we speak of what we know and testify to what we have seen, yet you do not receive our testimony. The first you swa is singular. Jesus is talking to one person, Nicodemus. The second, himin, is plural. John is addressing a wider audience. That oscillation between singular and plural, you, the and you, is matched by the I and we in the same verse. The whole passage seems to develop from the reporting of a conversation between Jesus and an individual Jew into the teaching of an audience by John, with no clear dividing line between the two. In fact, it's an example of what John's gospel is like as a whole. The historical memory of what Jesus did and said is used as the basis for a theologically developed piece of writing, and there are often few clear signals in the text of where one ends and the other begins.
Yeah, okay. I think it's clearest of all places in the gospel here, because we've no sense at what point in the chapter John stops quoting Jesus and starts addressing the congregation, the audience, by himself. It's very clear at the start he's reporting Jesus. It's very clear at the end that he's moved on from that and is teaching in a more general sense the readers of his gospel. And it's quite impossible to tell at what point it happens, because that you, we, that the you singular, you plural sort of interplay comes, to begin with, is all you singular, thee and thou. To end with is all you plural. But in the middle, it seems to sort of switch back and forth quite a bit, like in the verse I quoted. So there's quite an interesting theological point there about the nature of the gospel. It's not just a record of what Jesus said. It doesn't actually pretend to be. It goes beyond that. It doesn't mean it's inaccurate. It simply means that it's more than that.
And is that why, because we refer to the first three gospels in a different, what we call them the synoptic gospels, but we refer to John in a different way? because it is more theological teaching.
Yeah, it's a question of degree. I mean, John is certainly much more self-consciously adapting and using and manipulating the material to make various points. But doesn't say the other ones don't. So yes, it's a matter of degree, not that he does and they don't. But yes. Other reflections from people. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, thinking of the Bible as in some sense authoritative for us, the Word of God, whatever that means, without necessarily thinking, therefore, every single bit of it is 100% accurate. Meaning, for example, that there's a story in the Old Testament where the sun stopped going round for an hour so the battle could go on longer and the right people could win. Well, I mean, that didn't happen, let's face it. So, I mean, you know, there's a whole sort of range of stuff, isn't there, in terms of how literally one's going to understand each bit of it. And I think some Christians get very, I was going to say neurotic, that's a rude word, but they're quite touchy about all that. So somehow if you begin to question anything, then the whole thing falls apart.
Do you support in any way the idea that this gospel was written by a committee in the first century?
Yeah, I support the idea that John was ageing fast while he wrote it, and probably they put the finishing touches on it after he died. But I don't see any need to think most of it wasn't sort of him. The whole idea of a Johannine school out of which various documents came, you see, the letters of John, and possibly the book of Revelation. You know, I don't think that's all one individual. It's emerged from this particular branch of the church that seemed to incorporate a slightly different tradition from the rest. It seems very influenced by Mary's memories, for example.
But won't put people sort of comfortable with the idea of a committee? Because isn't Isaiah?
Yes.
It's Isaiah too.
Yes, how many Isaiahs were there? Yes, that's right. We had Isaiah 40 yesterday, perhaps you did in church, which was not written by the same person probably that wrote the beginning bit. So, yes. I think they'd be comfortable enough. I don't think it's problematic.
Well, I think we come to it now with a different view from in the Victorian times, don't we? Because we're more used to the whole idea of textual criticism. But the whole argument about science and religion was partly because people had been used to taking the Bible absolutely word literally. Mm. So to suggest that it wasn't made in 6 days cast doubt on everything that they believed.
It took them a while after Darwin.
It took a while. And there are still, I have met some Christians who still believe in 6 day creation, because that's what it says in the Bible.
All the world is 6,000 years old. Yes.
I mean, exactly.
There's a thriving church in Oxford. Mm. It's certainly its leaders are very much of that.
Yeah.
You know, if the Bible says it was 6 days, it's 6 days. End of.
That they combine an ignorance of science or whatever with an ignorance of Hebrew and Greek, you know, in terms of how words work. And it, because, I mean, yom in Hebrew for a day also means a period of time, an eon. And I think what's so fascinating about the 6 days of creation is it's unlike any other ancient text, because every society had its myth of how the world started, that the Hebrew scriptures alone get evolution in the right order. With people coming last after sort of fish becoming and reptiles and mammals and things. So, I mean, it does actually. I don't think it proves anything, but it's quite satisfying that it does actually get evolution in the right order. So that people who sort of say it's anti-evolution are completely bonkers. Mm. It's actually the first evolutionary text in that sense. Mm. Yeah.
Coming back to this verse 11, the singular and plural.
Yes.
When he says, I tell you, we speak. When he's saying we...
Yeah, I know.
Is that the royal we, do you think?
Well, you see, what's very interesting is that the whole chapter starts with Nicodemus using the plural. It's not in here. Master, we know that you are a teacher sent from God. But he starts using the plural. And there's a bit of debate as to whether there's a slight sense in which very highfalutin posh people, because he was highfalutin posh, like the French or the English royalty, we are not amused.
We are a grandmother.
Yes,
as you quote Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, that's right. Would actually sort of lapse into the plural. And whether Jesus is either playing with his own game, there's some commentators think that Jesus is sort of raising his game to match, really. You know, you can be posh, so can I. Or whether it's sort of what you're saying about a committee writing John, And so they sort of lapse into this sort of editorial committee telling people, look, hang on and believe this, folks. It's based on what Jesus said to Nicodemus, but it's really the teaching of the elders in the church. So I don't have a very clear answer to you. But yes, I think it is sort of significant. But it's very hard in any given verse to know how much weight to give each one.
Mm.
As I say, it's very clear at the beginning it's individual, very clear at the end it's plural.
It's interesting, the NIV tries to make the point towards the end of the verse where it says, we testify to what we have seen, but still you people do not accept our testimony.
It's making evident it's a plural in the Greek.
Yeah.
Yes. And you see, once you say about receiving testimony, you're right into the language of 1 John. We were talking about the water and the blood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's the testimony of the one who saw this is in that very verse. It's a great phrase of theirs. This is eyewitness stuff, and people need to accept it. So you're really looking at sort of the authority of the teacher somehow in this verse. Mm-hmm. We can't unpick it entirely. I can't give you the sort of the answer. But you're right, Liz, it's all in there.
Mm-hmm.
And all hinted at through the singles and plurals.
In English, there's so many words that on this, it's stuck. It lacks. It used to have one. I used to say the and thou.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Still do.
Yes, they still do.
But we leveled the playing field, leveled it out.
Yes, we have, haven't we?
Yes.
That's right. The French still keeps it.
Well, we have nous autres, too.
Yes.
And on, which is wonderful.
Yes, on is a marvellous word. But also to and vu, which they can
use. Well, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
It's southern England, isn't it? Because parts of particularly the northeast, they use different words.
Well, they would use the up there for quite a lot longer, for a century longer than they did in the south.
Northern Ireland, I mean, I haven't been for years now, but I used to go a lot. And you were always exactly clear whether it was you or you,
Yes, yous in Irish, and y'all in Texan, y apostrophe A-double-L.
Yeah.
Drink ye all of this. In the prayer book, the invitation to communion. It's the words of Jesus. Drink ye all of this. This is my blood. That's 17th century English that travelled to Texas or wherever, and it's still used by Americans. Ye all.
I understand that there was quite a dispute even at the time that between whether they should use thee or you.
Yeah.
It's not a wrong thing.
But the dispute is exactly back to front from now. Yeah. Now it's controversial. If I say, call God you in Eastleach, they get cross because I'm being too informal.
Yes.
They prefer thou and thee, which feels more formal. But the dispute you're mentioning was precise the other way round. But of course, thee and thou is too, that we were being too intimate with God.
Yeah.
And in Eastleach, they'd have told off the preacher in the 1500s if he didn't say you.
It also makes a barrier, doesn't it? If you're going to be so ceremonial with God.
Yeah, is God too or
thou? Not say, oh, yes. Get up, God! Exaudi Domine.
Yes, is God too or thou, you see?
And not the Psalms, you know.
Yeah.
Brilliant. The Psalms aren't, they are respectful, but they are also.
But I mean, yes, but the teaching of Jesus to treat God intimately is where the thee and thou comes from, and taught us to use thee and thou for God. Which we can't quite capture modern English.
No, it's sad, isn't it?
It is. We should start the Lord's Prayer by saying Dad rather than Our Father.
Well,
we're trying to catch the same thing.
Paul does his best, doesn't he? But even when he's writing to Greek speakers, he introduces the word Abba.
Yes.
To make the point.
Because it means daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a word for God. Yes. Okay, well, there's a general principle we hit there. It's not a mega thing. We're not into mega stuff yet.
Interesting.
But it is generally interesting. We get hints, don't we, of the combination of recollection of what Jesus did with the desire to teach the congregation who are hearing the gospel being read. That's the main point I'm talking about there. And the singles and plurals things there. We get into something slightly more definite now. I think of all that we're doing today, this is perhaps the most significant thing in the Greek, most interesting thing in the Greek. And it's your turn, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Hidden in Nicodemus' story is an almost comic misunderstanding. Jesus answered him, "Very truly I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born from above."
Nicodemus said to him, "How can anyone be born after having grown old? Can one enter a second time into the mother's womb and be born?" The Greek word anothen literally means from above, but it has another, probably more common meaning of again. It's a bit like the instruction da capo in a musical score, literally meaning from the top. It's an instruction to play the music a second time from the beginning.
And keep going.
So Jesus is trying to talk to Nicodemus about being spiritually alive, born from above. And Nicodemus is taking him more literally and thinks he's talking about being born again. No wonder Jesus says, exasperatedly, I can't say that.
You know what I mean. It's my spell check if you recognise it,
haven't I? Are you a teacher of Israel and yet you don't understand these things? And yet from this verse in the Old King James translation, we get the common phrase for Christians as having been born again. Because as with almost all examples in our sessions, the Bible translators haven't actually got it wrong. It's just that some of the range of meaning gets lost in translation. The word means either or both.
Yeah, I should spell that out. It means either from above or again, or both.
Okay.
Yeah, you see, it's the most... I think if we just have a cut through, whichever we translate as, we'd rather... lose the point of the story, because if Jesus says he must be born again and Nicodemus says how can I, again there's no problem there exactly. And if Jesus says from above, we think why does then Nicodemus talk about being born from the womb again, because it doesn't make any sense to say that. It's only when you realise that the word actually means both. And if you've been in an orchestra or a choir, sometimes the conductor will sort of tap the back of the music stand and say from the top, meaning sing the whole thing again, and that's how it means both. It literally means both, and I think we've got this sort of misunderstanding which John is playing on, how they're at cross purposes, and John is using this as a sort of teaching point about the nature of spiritual life. I've been born again, you see. I don't know how much we hear it in circles around here. I've mixed, as Mike certainly has in Christian circles, what evangelical ones, when it's become an absolute touchstone. You know, if you've not been born again, you're not a proper Christian. But I mean, okay, they're trying to say something quite important by that, but they're rather sort of taking little Bible phrases though as a magic wand that one has to sort of match, and yet the thing is more complex. I don't know if this phrase you've come across seems to have changed its meaning rather in my lifetime.
Yes, you referred to that when you preached on this passage a few weeks ago, that born again has become a shorthand for a specific type of Christian with a whole set of beliefs
and worship styles.
Yes, worship style as well. Yes.
Yeah.
And in the American context, political outlook as well.
Yes. Born again Christians vote for Trump.
Well, I think we're plucking along the road, and someone says, "And do you know Jesus?" Whoops. You know, it's one of those sudden things,
yes,
which attract at you, which you haven't actually thought through.
I heard somebody that said, "Have you found Jesus?" I don't know, is he lost again? Yeah.
But it's that sort of
it's that unthinking
cliche, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I just wonder with Nicodemus here whether the whole concept for someone so steeped in Judaism and everything that Judaism meant, to suddenly have someone who he's already acknowledged knows his stuff saying to him, "Yeah, but you've got to start over." He said, "What?"
Yeah, it certainly is. It's harder in a sense. You're absolutely right, surely, for those who are committed church people, as it were, to accept the idea of actually having to sort of go back to the first principles, because they spent years trying to do it, get it right. So yes, it's probably harder to receive. I mean, a lot of people want a fresh start. They know their life's gone wrong. They want a fresh beginning. But if you feel you're getting it right to begin with, as Nicodemus probably did, then the last thing you want is a fresh beginning.
Sorry, just thinking of East Leech.
Sorry, I mustn't use noise as a rude thing. But I just use the language example I was using earlier, which I think is rather, if only they could understand how bonkers it is.
And sometimes I think it can be used very insensitively. to very devout Christians who have grown up in the faith all their life to suddenly play the born again card at them. Yes, but have you been born again? I think it shows a lack of respect and understanding of the way God works in people's lives. He doesn't come to us all in exactly the same way.
Well, that's the thing, it's the arrogance, I think, or can be an arrogance.
I think it's an unintended arrogance, yes, quite often.
But it's in some ways all the more dangerous.
Yes.
It's a deeply rooted feeling that unless you're a Christian in the particular way that the speaker is, you're not a proper sort of Christian. Mm. I mean, there's a good question to be had there. I'm quite sure it's possible to be vaguely Christian and actually need to make further progress. Or even like Nicodemus, to start all over again, really. But
yeah.
It's the assumption the speaker has that they've managed that.
Well, it's almost, in a sense, I've arrived. But the whole thrust of the New Testament is anybody who thinks he's arrived hasn't. You know, please be patient. God's still working in me.
Jane, looking to you for a moment. I mean, you've been through a process at some stage of your life when you were outside the thing in quite a significant way, and now you're inside in a significant way. I mean,
I wouldn't like to think of it as...
No, okay, I was looking for you to sort of redirect my vocabulary, because I'm saying, to what extent does this sort of way of thinking and talking about it work for you?
Well, I think it's one of the major ways that Christians are ridiculed by people on the outside. The idea of... Well, you can see Nicodemus's reaction, and he's... It's something that's held against Christianity.
Rightly held against us because we are being arrogant, or wrongly held against us because people are ignorant?
Neither, really, that it is just totally irrational to think that you can be born again.
Yeah. Yeah, so actually the whole vocabulary just doesn't work.
No, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. Which, in a sense, is why it's so helpful. No, it doesn't just mean... Sorry. It doesn't just mean being born again. It's so helpful to understand that it's... It isn't just a naive phrase, but it's got this depth. It actually means from above, a spiritual birth. Sorry, yes.
I just think that the word pious and devout, all those things which were good adjectives, which are now...
People hear righteous as self-righteous, they hear holy as holier than thou, all these positive words.
Lots of them, there are quite a lot of them, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
Which filters into the bloodstream.
But born is very clear, is it? There's no nuance.
Yes, I will look that up, because actually a bit later on we're looking at being born and forgetting and stuff. John 3:3, is it?
Yes.
Yes, it is very clear. Genetha. We're going to come to that later over the page, actually, in a different context entirely. Genetha. Because I'm going to play this word a bit later, I'll put it up now. And in Greek, long E's and short E's are different letters, which is why I always distinguish them. Genetha. Yeah, it comes from a word, genao, there isn't an English word for it exactly, because it's either it's both, that is to say, and either is always the wrong word, it's both. The female part played in giving birth to a baby, and the male part. It's either to bear, as in to give birth to, or to beget. So both men and women genao a baby. There's no English word quite like that. So it's to become a parent of someone, and it can be used to men or women.
But it has to be both, doesn't it? Because if you beget from above, it would make much more...
Well, yes, but when it comes to the only begotten son, we're talking about God as a father, not a mother. I mean, we'll come to the same of the page. We'll come to the same of the page. Which is why, in English you've got to jump one way or the other. But actually both ways are wrong, as we'll see over the page.
I'm just surmising here, and I could be off on a flight of fancy, but I wonder if that's why... Because you've got the two aspects there in that word, is that also why you've got the water and the spirit type? connecting the two elements, as they say. Just a thought.
Just a thought. In fact, some commentators, it has to be said, if you don't mind me going into the medical aspect of it, actually take water, not so much as amniotic fluid, as semen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's been suggested, and not just by sort of trendy new ones, but it's an historic possibility. Partly because it is sometimes that the word water doesn't just literally mean water, it means fluid. And it's actually used elsewhere sometimes within the context you'd expect. In other words, context means clear what it means, but it is actually used to mean semen sometimes. So yeah, it's amazing what you learn when you dig in, isn't it? So, but in that sense, yes, it actually is. It's very much the physical word for being born. There's no two ways about it. It's to do with what happens to babies. I mean, you'll see over the page that where people, translators got tangled up, sometimes they started importing this vocabulary where it doesn't belong. But it does belong here in John 3:3. So, I mean, whether it's from above or it's, again, it's to talk about a fresh beginning either way, really. That's something needs to start. Yes. And of course, people's faith stories, sometimes it feels that's happened, sometimes, I don't know, Liz, would you, for yourself, or even perhaps for our children, you know, would you date any particular occasion in your life in which that was true, became true and hadn't been before?
I wouldn't have said so.
Whereas I would for me, because I wasn't really brought up as a Christian, so it depends on how your journey's gone, how well this vocabulary works, I think.
I was singing in church in the choir when I joined at 10. I mean, I'd been to Sunday school, but my parents didn't go to church.
No, so it really came
alive for
you.
I grew through the singing and the, I suppose you'd say the ritual in a sense, but because I was 3 times at church on a Sunday.
But yeah, amazing you still come then. I visit lots of people who tell me the reason they don't come is they went too often when they were young. They've used up all their church going for a lifetime.
But I mean, like Liz, I've got friends who could not tell you when they became a Christian. What they will say is there came a point in their life when suddenly they thought, yes, I believe all that. I'm a Christian.
Yes, I don't think it was even like that for me. It took me a long time.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us more. I mean, I'm interested in your story, if I may. It's a blessing to hear other people's stories. Jane, well, yes, go on. What did happen?
What did happen was that I was brought up initially as a Christian, did science at school and thought of myself as a scientist and found it totally irrational, but still, I wasn't an atheist.
Yeah.
But gradually through my life, things happened that disturbed me, and I began to seek more. I went through Buddhism, transcendental meditation, looking at all sorts of different aspects of things. Whenever I went to church, I had sermons which told me I'd go to hell if I was a sinner and I'd go to heaven if I was good. And as you might have worked out, I don't have a clear black and white approach to life. I think it's mostly grey in the middle, paradoxes. So I just thought that's not for me, but I was meditating. Then I went to a service with Patty and Tony, or mostly Tony, for Pentecost. And I just, the sermon and the atmosphere, I thought, this is a Christianity that I would like to get further into, which I did.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. People often talk about, having heard sermons, talk about good people going to heaven and bad people going to hell and so on. I suppose that happened. That's what you heard? Is it actually what was said?
Probably not, but that was my reaction.
Yeah, that's what you heard.
It was the clarity of what was good and what was bad.
Yes, indeed.
And the punishment of those who were not in line.
Oh dear, yes. No, come on, look. No, we'll put out your evolutions. No.
Now I can take it with a pinch of salt. Or
yes.
But yes. At that time, that was kept going with Buddhism. I was never quite at home with that. I was very glad to take the leap to Christendom.
Well, thank you for that. It's always such a blessing to hear people's stories. So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, we've done from the top. Have we anything more to do about more again? Okay, Liz, would you read the next section? A pneumatic double entendre.
Also, in the Nicodemus story...
Is it the bottom of the front page still?
In the Nicodemus story, we find an interesting double meaning that we met a couple of months ago when Jesus breathed on the disciples in the upper room. The wind blows where it chooses. You hear the sound of it, but you don't know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. The Greek word pneuma means both wind and spirit. So the punning analogy here is rather lost in translation.
Yeah, that's all I've said about it, because since it doesn't take us a great deal further into the theology, it just is an example of a pun that doesn't work in English. And so you get a number of those, really, when there's just no way you can signal it. It looks simply like an analogy here, a simile. It isn't a simile, it's actually a pun. And therefore, a little bit more powerful as an image, in other words, in the Greek. Now then, I thought, especially with Beulah here, we'd have a finicky interlude. finicky one. We go into some small detail.
In the nicest possible way.
I only work on broad lines.
Oh, right. Well, nevertheless, there's a level of detail we're going to go into here, which I think some people would find really tiresome rather than interesting. I do this three times, and the three groups have got very different characters. And certainly the group I do down in Welford, they really struggle with things like, well, it's adjunctives or it's subjects and objects. The eyes glaze over very quickly. And so this is a sort of eyes glazing over section. And it doesn't work for you, then just put it to one side. But I think...
Which is more polite, John.
Yes, it's right. When I drafted this morning, I gave it the subheading of Does God Have Sex? And I thought, no, that's going to get up some people's noses, so I won't use that heading. But it's actually what I wanted to say, because it's all to do with applying this word here to God, or not applying this word here to God, which is why the whole question, does God have sex, is in some ways it's the right question, but it's got a sort of colouring. I thought it made it dangerous as a subheading. I suppose I could say, does God have children, might have been slightly better, but then it's getting not
well,
quite...
Well, is God the creator?
Well, it is more than this, you see, that's why. It's more than this. Right. It's whether we use this word about God or we don't. Let's leave the section and you'll see. Beulah, we'll make you read this. Looking again at verse 16, will you read this whole section to us, please?
Also in the Nicodemus story.
No, hang on.
Turn the page.
Yeah, we've done that one. Over the page. Over the page. You've got your finicky interlude. Right.
You sure it's me?
I'm quite sure, but it is. it is now.
Looking again. A finicky interlude. Looking again at verse 16. There's a lot of buried theology in a little word. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life. Like being born from above in verse 3, this is an example of where the King James Bible falls short, and newer translations get it right. The English word only represents the Greek monogene.
Yes, very good.
One of a kind. But over the centuries, the word genus, kind, as in one of a kind, has often been tangled up with the word genio, to give birth, or in a man's case, to beget. We'll look at this again when we study chapter 1. But, cutting a long story short, when St. Jerome translated the Gospels into Latin, he always translated the word monogenes as unicus, unique, except when it referred to Jesus, when he translated it unigenitus, only begotten. Goodness, I never realised all this.
I thought you might have done it. I put it in for you, Eula.
It was a deliberate mistranslation to bolster his case against the Arian heretics, who claimed that Jesus was part of the created order rather than belonging to the eternal nature of God. And the begotten, not made phrase found its way into Christian theology and into the early translation of John's Gospel into English.
Okay, so those of you who know the Authorised Version will be very used to the phrase of Jesus being the only begotten Son of God. And I guess because we don't really use the word beget much in English, normally anyway, it sort of rather washes over us and we just think it's a fancy way of saying only. If we'd lived 300, 400, 500 years ago, we'd have a much more powerful sensation with that word because we'd know the word begotten, a word we would use in everyday life, meaning to have children. And so it's saying very powerfully that God had a child, Jesus. I mean, we're used to the idea of Jesus being the Son of God, but this is specifically making the point that in a rather human sense somehow, because the word ganao means to have sex and give birth, that God had a son. And of course this is something that other religions hold against Christianity, that it's almost disrespectful of God to suggest that he tangles himself up in such processes. And the idea of God having a son rather dilutes the specialness of God. And we might want to try and argue that rather differently about the nature of the relationship between Jesus and the Father. But we've been rather hampered by a mistranslation that we've had for many centuries, which brings only begotten into it, which is not there in Greek. And unigenitus is a Latin word made up by Jerome entirely to apply to Jesus, when in fact the same word is used, monogenes, as of any other use of the word only. So it means he's unique. It means Jesus is a son in the way that nobody else is. Yes, we may be sons and daughters of God, but not in the way that Jesus is. That's what monogenes means. It means one of a kind. Hebrews, of course, teaches that Jesus is the firstborn of many brothers and sisters. So it slightly goes against the monogenes to say, okay, what he was uniquely has become the birthright of all of us. But I think apart from that, the New Testament is quite careful to distinguish the relationship of Jesus to the Father.
So, where translators use his one and only, better?
That's the NIV again.
No, it is, well, it may be, but I'm just glancing at something called the New Century Version.
Yes, the NIV, which is the most best known translation to use that. That is trying to point up that it means unique, really.
Yes. Yeah. NIV does use that.
Yeah, one and only. It's a good translation because it gives an extra power to the word only, which is what monogenes does. You see, only in Greek is monos. Monogenes is a longer version which just beefs it up, really.
So, he gave his son, who was one of a kind,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is. The only son he had. I mean, the unique... That Jesus is a unique figure in the salvation of the world. God's unique answer. Other figures may help us in a variety of ways, but there's something unique about Jesus. That's the force of that verse. And once you start tangling it up with the idea of begetting, as I say, the word has lost its power now because we don't normally use it except of Jesus in the usage when we use the Authorised Version. But I think it's been a stumbling block in the past. The idea somehow the whole thing is too not exactly too sexual, too human, too anthropomorphic.
It's incredibly difficult to accept, actually. I think Jesus is the most difficult to accept of the three of them.
Oh, of the Trinity?
Yes.
What a refreshing way of putting it. Yes. I mean, a lot of people say the exact opposite. They can relate to Jesus, but all this God stuff leaves them cold. So, I mean, it just depends which end you come to, it, really.
It's so difficult. I mean, it must have been... What was it like living in his head when he was... He's sort of aware... Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? Yeah. And that was an amazing moment. He's got a man and... God?
Yes.
Yep.
It's a contradiction in terms.
Well, yes.
Yes.
Because one is almighty, yeah. Perfect, what's the name, and the other is all not that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I quite agree with you, Beulah. I think for many of us, we can subconsciously just think of it, drop into the idea of Jesus was God, and he sort of floated about the place and wasn't subject to all the woes and the trials and the tribulations and the agonies that we go through. And yet the whole thrust of Scripture is that he was fully God and he was fully human.
Yeah, it's really difficult one to get your head around.
And because it's so difficult, sorry.
But that's the whole point.
It is the whole point, yes.
It is that our faith is a mystery. We're not able to get our head around things.
Yeah.
And that emphasises it.
Yeah. In some ways, the whole redemption, our salvation depends on it being true, sort of. Because the Orthodox theologians say what God did not become, he could not redeem. That it's God's involvement in the human condition that made salvation possible. And if it wasn't God doing it, it wouldn't work either. I mean, I can't die for you. So, I mean, it's got to be both in a sense. But you're absolutely right. Once you start trying to get into psychologically what goes on inside Jesus' head, I think it's quite impossible. Quite impossible. And I think because it's so impossible to hold in the head, people inevitably one way or the other. The argument of sort of Jesus, as you say, was about God wandering around in disguise. You know, it wasn't really troubled in Gethsemane, or wasn't really nagging on the cross.
Yes.
Or uncertain of the outcome, I think, is quite important for the cross. Or the other way around. He was just a chap, and people have overblown it ever since by making him divine.
I think that if God had gone to his PR man and said, you know, give me a story that will bring in everybody, and read the script afterwards, there must have been some form of doubt in his head. Yes. Is this going to work?
I thought he's taking himself for a walk. Has he given up waiting
for us?
He just
leapt down the steps. I can still see him. So he'll come.
No, he hasn't gone too far then.
He's come out waiting for a walk with us, thank you.
But Jane is so right, and it's part of the... I hope you won't understand what I'm saying here. It's part of the arrogance of the human condition.
Yes.
That we think we must be able to... If we try hard enough, we're going to make sense of this.
Yeah.
And if we can't, well, it's God's fault, not ours. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I don't think it is. I don't know that follows on.
No, but...
But it's emphasised because, I mean, Jesus very rarely says something clear. He's always answering questions with another question.
Yeah.
So all he seems to want us to do is to believe and think and use our brains, and we'll never catch hold of it, but it's a fascinating process.
Yes.
I often wondered at what point Jesus realised the weight on his shoulders. I mean, when you go back to when he was 12 in the temple and how he was answering the elders' sort of questions or telling them whatever he was telling them, extremely knowledgeable, and then nothing until he starts his sort of mission much later.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder what he did in that time.
Well, yes.
It gets worse, because he's not only God and man, he's bread and wine.
Ah.
Yeah.
I shan't be wrong.
That's getting tricky, isn't it?
I shan't be wrong. No. Well, in a sense, this is a conversation that can go a long way. Has she not managed to round the dog up, poor woman?
Well, I thought she had, but...
You're now chasing him down the hill, is she?
Then she went down. Did she go down the steps?
Or I can't see the...
Did she leap down the steps?
The window.
Well?
She started
whatever you call that bit of the window is right in the way.
I think he could do a runner.
You can tell he's getting fed up.
I think he leapt over the steps and then had a poo somewhere.
Yeah, well, he's also been having
he's clearly more at home in the Welford group than this year.
He has been having, I don't want to avoid the dog's intestinal workings, he's been having a bit of a problem the last day or so. So I think
it's good that he went out.
Exactly, very good. And he probably wants to go away just to be polite. But, never mind. He's, yes. Okay, I think we won't wait for Liz to carry on then. Let's do the next bit. So
could I just say at this point, without going any further than this, it's an interesting point you raise here about, I think you use the phrase, a deliberate mistranslation.
There's a bit mischievous of me.
Well, no, because, I mean, there are other examples of that throughout church history where people have, where it's ambiguous, people have deliberately jumped one way to suit their own ends, but...
I think that's right, and I think, to be frank, it was deliberate. He didn't accidentally choose two different words, and I think it is a mistranslation, because he's really importing a lot of complexity by saying unigenitus. It does not mean that. So, yes, I think he sort of fell prey to temptation to do that. It wasn't malice, it was an eagerness to...
He probably prayed a lot about it and thought God was telling him.
You're absolutely right, like all the worst crimes.
Yes.
But it's a glimpse to what lies behind some of these things that have really, you know, what lies behind the creeds and things. Mm. A huge amount of human, manipulating. Okay, Jane, the woman of Samaria.
How far do you want me to read?
I don't know, really. I think... Yes, and now to Jesus and the woman, so the first three bits.
The delightful story in chapter 4 has few big surprises in the original Greek, although, as always, a knowledge of biblical languages gives deeper insight into almost every verse. Two passages may be of interest. Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." Two separate features of husband, aner, are interesting. The word literally means not a husband, but simply a man. There is a debate to be had about the biblical understanding of marriage, and individual texts cannot be easily marshalled to promote one view above another. For example, Jewish teaching of Jesus' time held that up to three husbands consecutively was harming. But more than that number, although legal, was regarded as disreputable.
Sue has joined us for 4 o'clock, so we'll let her in and we'll go with this with her. Sue, welcome. What we'll do is each of us will take turns to tell what we've learned. Don't worry, you will get an extra dose of this because we're going to tell you what we've learned from them.
Why was it three suddenly?
Because it wasn't three. Why was it three? It's always three.
She's on her feet again. What? On her feet again?
Yes, it's usually three.
I think it's usually three.
Yeah.
I got cold feet this afternoon, what time it's going to be, so I thought I'd start when people turned up.
Is it three?
I didn't know.
Sorry, I wouldn't have come if I
well, I couldn't have come.
Well, like I said, I'm glad you did come.
We come to you at four, don't we? So that was probably
yes,
in your head.
I thought this was sorry.
Yeah. Don't worry. That's us all. We're having a bit of fun here. Would you go back? I'll show you where we are. And we're going to go back into some stuff just to make sure we learned it properly. Well, we'll start again with two separate features of husband.
Two separate features of husband, Anna, are interesting. The word literally means not a husband, but simply a man. There is a debate to be had about the biblical understanding of marriage. And individual texts cannot be easily marshalled to promote one view above another. For example, Jewish teaching of Jesus' time held that up to three husbands consecutively was fine. But more than that number, although legal, was regarded as disreputable. More interesting to my mind is not the English but the Hebrew, where a husband is Baal, which means also pagan god. Ah. The historian Josephus writes that when the Assyrians colonized Samaria, they brought five pagan gods with them. Is this perhaps buried somehow in the story of Jesus and the woman.
Just a thought. But let's take those two quite separate thoughts first. The one is about the man as a husband. It's very interesting, isn't it? You know, we think we didn't work out what marriage is, and we know what a husband is and what a wife is and stuff. And it does us good occasionally just to remember how culture-bound this is. The steps you need to go through now to be married are not the same as they were even 500 years ago, let alone 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Many, one could almost say most of the couples that I marry are already married in a biblical sense when I marry them, because their relationship is publicly recognised and they are sleeping and living together. So, I mean, that's just about, you know, the idea that somehow the church has to be involved, or the state has to be involved, or in the case of the Church of England, both at the same time, is in some ways a modern construct. So all I'm saying is that, I mean, the whole question of what is a marriage relationship in the sight of God will vary culturally from place to place. And monogamy, and what's more, the disallowing of divorce, is really quite a sort of Christian thing, arising out of the teaching of Jesus, of course, but nevertheless, culturally speaking, it's been observed in the breach as much as in the following. And now, I mean, it's very accepted in the church, not the Church of Rome, but I mean, even very biblical Christians like evangelicals seem quite unexcited about divorce, pretty unexcited about divorce, and very excited about gay stuff. So, I mean, we just need to remember the culture lying behind it. So, I mean, even here, for example, Jesus is not giving a moral lecture about the nature of marriage, primarily. It's something to do with the appropriateness or depth of relationship, no doubt. And, I mean, if this chap wasn't a man, what was he? Perhaps he was somebody else's man who used to visit on Tuesday nights, you know. I mean, it's, we don't know what lies behind it, but we can't make too many assumptions about it and start getting excited.
But I think that exactly picks up the point that Bueller's making. Jesus has got that insight. He knows. You know, when she's talking,
yeah,
he knows already what the situation is. He doesn't have to be told.
Yes, and it's what persuades the woman he's the Messiah, because he appears to have supernatural knowledge. So certainly Bueller's point about what's going on in his head is significant. But exactly what was going on in his head is hard for us to know, to what extent what marriage meant in that culture and what the situation was, and was she divorced or widowed or what.
But that also continues that it's vague. Yeah. He's not saying definitely this is wrong or this
no, he's
is
not, you see.
No.
He's accepting.
Yeah. Yes, quite.
Exactly whatever he meant by it, he doesn't then rebuke her when she says
no,
this.
Yeah.
But the point I was seeking to make is Jesus knows more than what the words are telling him.
Yes, indeed. But also being John's gospel, you think, how many different levels of meanings it got? Because you like, and I rather like this fact that the Hebrew, and also the Samaritan, by the way, for husband is Baal, which we always think of as being a pagan god, little Elijah.
Okay. Yes.
Yes, well, I mean, that's just, it's actually the generic word for a pagan god, really, is Baal. And once you realise that the Samaritans had five pagan gods, and here they were, she's trying to adopt Yahweh as another one when talking to Jesus, you know, the Jewish God, but he's not really her God. There could be some sort of undercurrent of theological challenge in it, but completely lost to us in its detail. There's an example of what John writes and thinks, I think.
Can you clarify, Samaritans?
Yeah.
I understood that they were Jews that separated because they believed something.
They were Jews gone wrong, initially. Yes. I mean, well, yes, they were.
But they're not a separate unit to begin with.
They were 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel, initially.
Yes.
And at the time of, what's the king called, Liz?
Jeroboam.
I think it was Jeroboam. Well done. The time of Jeroboam. And then his son, Rehoboam, finally had an official break. They split away. But after that, don't forget that the northern kingdom was taken into exile at a different time of history from when the southern kingdom was.
Mm.
And unlike the southern kingdom, when the Jews came back, as in yesterday's reading from Isaiah 40, they all came back as a sort of unit. And there was a great ritual purity amongst them. I mean, Ezra and Nehemiah were very strict about putting away foreign wives and foreign gods, rebuilding the temple. There was a lot of emphasis on keeping racial and religious purity. When the 10 tribes came back, they didn't exactly come back. The Assyrians merely transplanted people back into Samaria, which included some of the original inhabitants. The whole thing was much vaguer. And some historians say they colonized from 7 cities. Josephus says 5, each bringing their own city god with them.
So it was mixed up. It was mixed marriage stuff and mixed paganism and Judaism spiritually.
And there was the whole thing about how they viewed Jerusalem as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, the woman gets into that because they had a separate... Yeah. They did have a separate place.
Because, I mean, the earliest relics and everything were found in Samaria, I think.
Mm. I mean, historically, they're as Jewish as anybody else.
Yeah.
But it all got rather more mixed up.
Mm.
And a bit like Sunni and... Well, a bit like Catholic and Protestant, or a bit like Sunni and Shiite, that actually is those you're closest to you fight most, and some of the jockeying for position between Jews and Samaritans, they probably hated them more than they hated the Romans. It was tribal, really.
Well, that was the point of the parable, wasn't it?
Mm.
The
Good Samaritan, yes.
The priest and the Levite hadn't done that.
Yeah. Let's do our last paragraph, then I'm going to test you for Sue's sake on what we did earlier.
Thank you.
Mike, would you read the second phrase in chapter 4?
The second phrase in chapter 4 that may be of interest comes at the end of that same story. The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I am he, the one who is speaking to you." We looked at this in chapter 18. Ego emi, EMI, has echoes of the name of God. We'll look at this in more detail in a few months' time.
Yeah, so we're going to, just noticing it, we'll see it in several chapters. If you were here 3 months ago, you will remember that bit about the name of God. I won't go on about it now.
Can you just remind me, please, how I should have said that?
Yeah, ego Amy.
Amy.
Yeah, like that girl's name. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, it's just a little thing. And you see, and what's more, again, I typically in John, the phrase gets used in a place that has messianic echoes. She's saying, we've heard the Messiah's coming, and he's saying, ego Amy. So he's picking up a sort of... A God moment, to use the phrase. So it's not just, well, it is just linguistically. Don't forget, everything you look at is both. It's not either or. That's the whole point of one of these sessions. It's got that depth, it's got that range. It not only literally means I am he, as a normal Greek expression, it's how any Greek would say I am he, is echoing. But at the same time, it's got echoes.
Mm.
So that's the point. But we'll do it much more.
Should we regard this statement in the same way as we regard I am the light of the world, I am the good shepherd?
I thought this is one of the weakest of them.
Okay.
Because anybody would have said ego Amy here. Not anybody would have said ego Amy the good shepherd. Mm. It's an odd thing to say. And we're going to look at it again, or properly, or most of all, when we get that strange chapter. Is it chapter 8? Before Abraham was born, I am.
I am. Mm.
And what you've got there is you've got Jesus contrasting Gennai, we've been looking at today, as being a human situation, with his own situation, ego Amy, which is not that. But I won't preempt that. I'll talk to it again in chapter 8. It's to do with the nature of existence, really.
And they're all, I am who I am.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, yes. What do I say? They never used ego Amy as a way of translating Yahweh.
Mm.
It was never actually used like that, but Yahweh does mean ego Amy.
Mm.
It is it's not quite, it's more the third person. Yahweh is the one who is. I like to translate I am Yahweh as I am the one who is. But we'll do this more in chapter 8. It's a contrast between a contingent sort of being. We are only passing through, we know we are, but we're only passing through. The molecules in our bodies will be somebody else in a few years' time, with a existential way of being, Amy, which is not contingent, is not created. It just is. The God, in that sense, is the only one who truly is. The rest of us are just sort of results of God's creative love, and only passing through. But we'll do that more in chapter 8.